Hello and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper for Wednesday, June the 29th. I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher. And the headline for this first story, Sioux City Man Charged with Arson. And this article was written by reporter Dolly Butts. A Sioux City man was arrested Monday in connection with a vehicle fire. Shaw Keem Goodman, 27, is charged with one count of first-degree arson. And first-degree arson is a Class B felony. At 12:56 p.m. on Monday, Sioux City Fire Rescue and the Sioux City Police Department were notified of a car on fire inside of a garage in the 1800 block of Virginia Street. And according to a statement from the police department, witnesses reported seeing three people next to the garage when the fire opened. Officers found the subjects a short distance away and detained them, as it had been determined that arson was the cause of the fire. The other two individuals were released without charges. Headline, Lang sentenced to life in prison for trooper slaying. And this article was written by reporter Jeff Reinitz. A Grundy Center man has been sentenced to life in prison for killing an Iowa State Patrol trooper during a 2021 standoff. Under Iowa law, Michael Thomas Lang, 42, will not be eligible for parole on a charge of first-degree murder. He was also sentenced to a consecutive 30 years for attempted murder and assault on an officer. He was also ordered to pay $150,000 in restitution to the estate of Sergeant Jim Smith. Judge Joel Dalrymple handed down the sentence on Monday morning in Grundy County District Court. In May, a jury found Lang guilty of first-degree murder in Smith's death, as well as attempted murder for shooting at another trooper who was driving around in an armored vehicle at the end of the standoff, and for an assault on an officer for fighting with a Grundy Center police officer during a traffic stop that sparked the incident. Authorities said Lang refused to pull over for an April 9, 2021 speeding stop, and instead lured the police officer into a rural area where he knocked away his taser and began struggling with him. A passerby and a sheriff's deputy intervened, and Lang drove home and refused to come out for police. Smith was shot in the chest and leg with slugs from a shotgun when he and others attempted to enter the kitchen to apprehend Lang. And the headline for this next article, City Council greenlights ordinance to regulate after-hours clubs. And this news article was written by reporter Dolly Butts. Sioux City Council unanimously voted this past Monday to adopt an ordinance that will require after-hours clubs within city limits to be licensed. Over the last several years, these kind of clubs, which operate between 2 and 6 a.m., have been the site of multiple shootings and other criminal activity. Under the new ordinance, after-hours club owners will be required to pay $175 to apply for or renew a license, and the license will be valid for 1 year. And as a condition of the application, owners will consent to allowing the city's inspection services and fire departments to inspect the premises to confirm compliance with city code standards. Police officers will be allowed to enter the clubs during operating hours to confirm that alcoholic beverage laws are being complied with. This shows that you prioritize our citizens' safety. And that's something that's truly important. And that is a quote from Councilman Matthew McCain. He told Sioux City Police Chief Rex Mueller and Assistant City Attorney Stephen Pastolka before the vote. And O'Kane asked Pastolka how many clubs are currently operating in the city and if they will be notified about the new ordinance that was passed. To my knowledge, there is only one after-hours club currently operating. I suppose we could send them a notification sometime, said Pastolka, who noted that clubs have 180 days after the ordinance goes into effect before needing to be in compliance with it. No one under 21 will be permitted in an after-hours club during the hours of operation between 2 and 6 a.m. No one under 21 will be permitted in an after-hours club during the hours of operation, and the clubs cannot be located in areas of the city that are zoned residential or areas of the city that operate within any premises that has a liquor license. Under the current city code, consumption of alcoholic beverages on premises accessible to the public is prohibited from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. on weekdays and Saturdays, and from 2 a.m. to 8 a.m. on Sundays. An after-hours club in violation of the ordinance will be declared a nuisance, and the owner of the premises at which it operates it will be guilty of a municipal infraction, and that's according to the current language of the proposed ordinance. Its license will be suspended if the licensee or the licensee's employee, agent, or contractor committed, quote, a specific criminal intent at the club, or recklessly allowed one to occur there, or was ordered to abate a nuisance at the club. An after-hours club's license will be revoked if the licensee or the employee's licensee, agent, or contractor committed or knowingly allowed another to commit murder or voluntary manslaughter. The license will also be terminated if the club's license had been suspended within the previous 12 months and the licensee or the licensee's employee, agent, or contractor once again committed a criminal incident or knowingly allowed one to occur there. The city manager will then issue a letter of intent to deny, suspend, or revoke an after-hour club's license. Licensees will be allowed to request a hearing to contest any denial, suspension, or revocation within 20 days of the letter. In the early morning hours of October 10th of 2021, officers were dispatched to a shots-fired call at an after-hours club at 427 Pierce Street, where they found a male victim with a life-threatening gunshot wound to his upper body. A short time later, three other victims arrived at hospitals with non-life-threatening injuries. The shooting was the result of a dispute between two groups of people who were at the club, which has since closed, and that's according to police. And the headline for this next article, Construction Trades Building Bid Accepted, Estimated Completion November 2023. And this article was written by Caitlin Yamada. And the headline for this next article, Construction Trades Building Bid Accepted, Estimated Completion Date November 2023. And this news story was written by reporter Caitlin Yamada. The Sioux City School Board has approved the construction of space for the construction trades education. In a unanimous vote, the board accepted a $3.8 million bid from H&R Construction of South Sioux City. The project will total $4.5 million with architectural and engineering fees. The construction trades building will be attached to the Harry Hopkins Center on Highway 75 and is intended to provide a controlled environment for students to complete various building projects. The 12,000 square foot building will be added to the west side of the facility, and it'll provide space for students to build houses or other small buildings. That's according to Tim Paul. He is the District Director of Operations and Maintenance. The board approved two additional alternatives that were included in the bid price. Director of Operations and Maintenance Tim Paul said that one alternative was to add chain hoist in the building. H&R Construction quoted $31,000 for that job, and the other alternative was two different company options for temperature control. H&R Construction quoted a low option of $53,000 from Star Controls. There were other alternatives in the bid that were added in the proposed project in case the bids came higher than estimated. These alternatives were to change to a cheaper insulation, eliminate painting of the existing building exterior and different concrete masonry. And Paul said they did not want to move forward with these alternatives. Matt Basie of the Sioux City architectural firm FEH Design previously said the building will include two construction bays, one classroom, storage space, and restrooms. And he said the project was a part of a master plan developed 5 or 6 years ago for the Harry Hopkins facility. The project will also clean up the appearance of the Hopkins facility, which houses food services in the district's current trade school. The facility is named for Harry Hopkins. He was a Sioux City native and a member of the administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt. The completion date for the project is November 1st, 2023. And as far as the money, the project will be paid from elementary and secondary education relief funding. And the headline for this next article, Field of Dreams television series awarded grant. And this article was written by Tom Barton of the Journal's Des Moines Bureau. The state of Iowa will invest in the development of a Field of Dreams television series, new trail construction, and new Des Moines lakefront amenities. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and the Iowa Economic Development Authority on Monday announced a $16.5 million grant money awarded to four projects in the first round of funding through Destination Iowa. That's a program supported by the Federal American Rescue Plan Act. The $100 million program, announced in April, invests in, quote, transformational attractions that will bolster the quality of life in Iowa communities and attract visitors and new residents, according to a news release from the governor's office. Project awarded grant funding so far are $6 million for Universal Television for the development of a Field of Dreams television series. Filming will be based in several Iowa communities, including those in Polk, Mahaska, Boone, and Clinton counties. Plans include set construction of a ball field and refurbished farmhouse in Polk City. $7 million to the Siouxland Regional Trail System to develop 100 miles of continuous trail projects connecting Sioux City, Lamars, Hinton, Merrill, and Sargent Bluff, Iowa. The project will also include the Cone Mountain Bike Park. That's an 18.5-mile plywood trail and a 4.3-mile Los Hills Scenic Trail, so plenty of biking options. $2.5 million of the job will go to Polk County Conservation for the Easter Lake North Shore Project. According to a news release, this project will provide an accessible recreational hub for rowing and swimming, fishing, and other water sports. $1 million to Dallas County Conservation to complete a 4-mile trail connection linking two existing trails in central Iowa, the Raccoon River Valley and High Trestle Trail. Once completed, the project will create a 120-mile continuous loop of the trail. The Gazette reported last month the 7-part Field of Dreams prequel series will be streamed next year on Peacock, taking a deeper dive into the backstory and characters from the beloved Kevin Costner film. Dyersville, which is the location where the 1989 baseball movie was shot, however, is not on the series docket, as it will be filming around the time Major League Baseball returns to the site for a regular season game between the Chicago Cubs and the Cincinnati Reds on August 11th. On August 9th, the Cedar Rapids Colonels will take on the Quad Cities River Bandits in minor league action. The television series will use local crews, suppliers, and vendors for construction, catering, transportation, and set decoration, a news release says. Renovo Media Group of Clear Lake will bring equipment and expertise, and Muco Lighting and its subsidiary, Iowa Sports Turf, will help light, design, and construct the baseball field. The Iowa Employment Department and Economic Development Agency will continue to review applications as they arrive through December 31st or until funding for the project runs out. And the headline for this next article, Greenwell responds to transparency comments and presents a timeline. This article was written by reporter Caitlin Yamada. Sioux City School Board President Dan Greenwell said on Monday, the search for an interim superintendent and associate superintendent did not lack transparency, in spite of recent comments from fellow board members suggesting the opposite. Greenwell posted a timeline spanning from February to June of the superintendent and associate superintendent search process, specifically highlighting when information was presented to the entire board. Greenwell said there hasn't been enough information communicated on the timeline, but it has been a transparent process, he says. It has been complete and transparent this whole time, both in the closed sessions and in the public, he said. Board members Perla Alicorn-Flory and Monique Scarlett previously claimed that Rod Earlywine's selection for the interim superintendent position lacked transparency. Scarlett and Alicorn-Flory accused a committee of board members of not following an agreed-upon plan. The pair said the board never agreed on a single candidate before it was presented to the board for approval. And when a contract to hire Earlywine was presented to the board, the two members dissented. Alicorn-Flory and Scarlett said they could not approve Earlywine's contract because district staff and the public were not given an opportunity to offer input into the potential candidates, and the agreed process, they say, was not followed. Alicorn-Flory also said the selection of an associate superintendent lacked transparency. Angela Bemis was approved on June 13th to serve as the district's new associate superintendent, and the board approved Bemis as a senior director beginning July 1st with the condition that she obtain her superintendent license by August 13th. And after Bemis obtains her state license, the board said they will be asked to change her job title to associate superintendent. The senior director position was listed with hundreds of other job changes in a human resources report as a part of the board's consent agenda. Alicorn-Flory then asked for more discussion about the associate superintendent job, admitting that she did not realize earlier that the position had been included in the human resource packet. This is a chief academic officer, and I think we need to be very transparent about it with the community, Alicorn-Flory said. On May the 9th, Greenwell read a letter in which Earlywine recommended Bemis as the associate superintendent. Greenwell has disagreed with Alicorn-Flory and Scarlett's assertions that the process lacked transparency. And he said the comments and discussions have told him that over-communication is key in the future. In March of this year, the board approved a $15,000 contract with the Omaha firm of GR Recruiting. That's a company that specializes in recruiting for educational leadership roles to help with the search for a new superintendent. And at the same time, the board also decided to appoint an interim superintendent to give time for the community and the district to give input on the selection of a permanent superintendent for the school district. Greenwell said the process will start in early or mid-September, and the board will decide how to proceed with community input He said the future process has not been changed due to the transparency comments. And the headline for this next story, three finalists named for Iowa Supreme Court opening. And this story was written by Aaron Murphy of the Journal's Des Moines Bureau. The Iowa Supreme Court's next justice will be one of three finalists announced on Monday by the state's Judicial Nominating Commission. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds will choose from among the three finalists who are, according to a news release from the state court system, Alan Heavens. He is a Northeast Iowa judge from the 1st District from Guerrero-Navillo and a former Clayton County attorney. David May, an Iowa Court of Appeals judge from Polk County, Iowa, and a finalist for the Iowa Supreme Court vacancy back in 2020. And William Miller, a lawyer with Dorsey and Whitney in Des Moines, and a previous applicant for an Iowa Supreme Court opening. A Sioux City judge, Patrick Todd, was one of the original five applicants. He did not make the list of finalists. The governor has 30 days, or until July 27th, to choose the next Iowa Supreme Court justice. Once she does, five of the high court's seven justices will have been picked by Reynolds. Now, this latest opening is being created by the retirement of Justice Brent Apple, who is the court's last remaining member appointed by a Democratic governor, Tom Vilsack, in 2006. Apple was also retained by voters in the 2016 judicial retention elections. Apple this summer turned 72, the age at which Iowa judges are required by law to retire. Five candidates applied for the opening. All of the candidates were interviewed Monday by the 17-member State Judicial Nominating Commission, which is made up of eight lawyers and nine members appointed by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. Headline for this next news article, Lincoln Dentist hopes to inspire future women to pursue profession. This article was written by reporter Jenna Ebers of the Lincoln Journal Star. There was never any question whether Dr. Susan Christensen would be a dentist. She was raised to be one. Counting numbers and the ABCs weren't the only thing she learned early in life. Her mother, who worked as a dental hygienist, taught her how to sew, cross-stitch, and write upside down and backwards. All fine motor skills that her mother said would help her become a great dentist. I felt like I was kind of groomed for it, she said. And so now, with more than 40 years of experience, Christensen works to install the same lifelong passion for dentistry in other women. I'm a big supporter of encouraging women to do anything, Christensen said. Go for your dreams and remember that you can still do it all. You can have a wonderful career, wonderful home life, and a wonderful family all at once. Don't let anyone tell you what your limits are. Christensen comes from a long line of male dentists in her family, including her grandfather and father. Eastview Family Dental, now at 5640 South Street in Sioux City, was first opened by Christensen's grandfather in 1922 and celebrated its 100th anniversary last month. Christensen's father later owned the practice as well. And she then teamed up with her father at Eastview Family Dental immediately following her graduation from the University of Nebraska Medical Center College of Dentistry in 1981, and they became the first father-daughter practice anywhere in the Midwest. It has been such a privilege to work here, Christensen said, and I am so proud of my family. I just absolutely adore them. I got to watch my dad and grandfather love dentistry, and I made it very clear, and then it was really easy for me to see that I wanted to do the exact same thing. When she first began her career, the profession was very heavily male-dominated. the rate of female graduates from the UNMC College of Dentistry has steadily increased from 9% in the early 80s to 56% this year. In the beginning, not everyone was willing to allow a woman to work on their teeth, she said, but that didn't stop her. People would call and say, "Wait, is this a woman? I'll wait a year to see your dad instead," Christensen said. "But now I really feel like it's flipped blocks." Christensen focuses on empathy, compassion, and kindness, which she believes has been a big factor in the change in narrative. Her niece by marriage, Erica Etzmiller, who will graduate from dental school in 2024, agreed. "I think it's little things where people might not think you're as qualified because you're a woman in dentistry. But as soon as you're able to do a good job on them, a lot of times they realize that women do make great dentists because we are really naturally very empathetic and good caregivers," Edsel Miller said. Edsel Miller plans to join her own father at Pine Lake Dental once she graduates from UNMC and is also following in her grandfather's footsteps, just like Christensen. And while Edsel Miller's class is over half female, unlike Christensen, who graduated with 8 other women, she still has experienced people doubting her choice to become a dentist. "When you tell people as a girl that you are in dental school, they automatically assume you mean dental hygiene school or dental assisting school," she said. "And I think that while the numbers of applicants in dental school right now reflects more girls than boys, society still thinks of a dentist as being male." Outside of the office, Christensen travels across the world to lecture on orthodontics is an adjunct professor at UNMC, Spear Education Visiting Faculty, and she's also a fellow in the International College of Dentists. She is also a member of the Nebraska Dental Association, the American Academy for Cosmetic Surgery, and the American Dental Associations. And oftentimes when lecturing, she has women ask her how she has managed to maintain a successful career as well as a tight-knit family. "The key," Christensen said, "is finding balance. Something's got to give," the mother of 3 and now grandmother said. "So what if your laundry isn't always done on time and you didn't fix the perfect meal for your family? Something's got to give if you want to be a great wife, mother, practitioner, and a family member." Joanne Harrington has been a patient at Eastview Family Dental for more than 7 years. And she said she's stuck with Christensen because of her kindness, background, and interest in others. "She cares about her patients," Harrington said. "I am very, very much in awe of what she has done in her life, especially in a field that was totally dominated by men when she entered it all those years ago. But it's also obvious her skill that drew me to her. She is one of the best dentists. I just don't let every nice person drill on my teeth." And the headline for this article, Henry County to replace roofs at old and new courthouse. And this article was written by reporter Lisa Hammer. The Henry County Courthouse is getting a new roof. The county board voted 14-0 on Thursday to approve a $3,749,000 project to replace the roof in the bell tower of the old courthouse and replace the roof over the newer courthouse and jail complex. 6 board members were absent: Natalie Collins, Sean Kendall, Angie Frank, Dwayne Anderson, Daniel Crippen, and Melissa Sandberg. And because of the availability of the Schebler work crew, the tentative plan is to do the roof over the newer courthouse and jail this fall and the older courthouse later this spring. 8 layers of roofing will be taken off of the old courthouse, with the most recent layer being at least 30 years old. Doug Zamaris of Roofing Technologies of Davenport and Shay Bauer of Dankin told the board they believe the original roof from the 1800s was still in place, and the layers of roofing were 1 3/4 inches thick. The board considered leaving the bell tower from the tower on the ground, as it is supported by a wood structure, and the wood is rotted. The 2,000-pound bronze bell sits on a concrete foundation that would need to be poured on the ground, and it would be $4,000 in additional cost to put it on the ground, as opposed to going back up on the roof. And the men also say the bell is rung when an external hammer hits the exterior of the bell, and the resonance wouldn't be as great as when on the ground. You are listening to the Sioux City Journal newspaper dated Wednesday, June the 29th, here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituary. Margaret M. McKenna, 86, of South Sioux City, passed away on June 11 at her residence. She was born August 23, 1935, in Sioux City to Bert and Ruth Bloomfield McKenna. She worked as a clerk for Lipman's, for TGNY, and for Holiday Inn. She is survived by her sister, Connie Quaid Lee, nieces and nephews. She was known as Aunt Sis, too. She was also survived by Haley Bachman, John and Noel Quaid, Jessica Quaid, and Charlie Daigle, and her great-grandnephew, her little character, Leo Quaid. She was preceded in death by her parents, Bert and Ruth, and by her sister, Retta Preston. Memorials in Margaret's name may be directed to Siouxland Active Generations. Kathleen A. Kathy Lance, 72, of South Sioux City, passed away on Tuesday, June 21st, at a local hospital. Kathy was born on December 2nd, 1949, in Winnebago, Nebraska. The daughter of Roland and Betty Thompson Hunter, she was a lifelong resident of South Sioux City. On June 30th, 1972, she married Larry Nance in Sioux City. The two settled in South Sioux City, and to this union one son was born, Tyson Lance. She was a member of the Red Hat Society, the Teachers Retirement Association, and the Tangled Yarns Knitting Group. She was also a member of the First Presbyterian Church of South Sioux City. Kathy loved visiting with people. She routinely attended the Thompson family reunions and loved spending time with that side of her family. She also enjoyed working on family ancestry and genealogy projects, as well as knitting and painting in her spare time. She is survived by her husband, Larry Nance, son Tyson Lance, grandchildren Isaiah Caden, Donovan and Case, brother Tom Hunter, several nieces and nephews, sister-in-law Colleen Pranger, brother-in-law Jeff Lance, brother-in-law Richard Lance, and her beloved cat Lulu. She was preceded in death by her parents, grandparents, parents-in-law, and two cats, Lady and Lucky. John Francis Gard of Lexington, Kentucky, but formerly of Sioux City, died at the age of 76 on Wednesday, June 22nd, surrounded by his family. John was born on November 18, 1945, in Sioux City to Lowell and Francis Gard. He grew up on the family farm east of Sioux City, Iowa. He graduated from Lawton High School and went on to earn a business administration degree from Wayne State College in 1968 in Wayne, Nebraska. In the fall of 1968, John enlisted in the United States Marine Corps, and after basic training, John was commissioned and sent to officer candidate school and became a first lieutenant, serving his country in the Marine Corps until the spring of 1972. After his service in the Marines, John went to work for the United States Department of Education as an accountant till his retirement in 2017, when he moved back to Lexington. He is survived by his son, Michael Gard, of Colorado Springs, Colorado, daughters Erica and her husband, Nick Tate, of Colorado Springs, Denise Gard, also of Colorado Springs. He is also survived by grandson Jonathan Gard and his significant other, Carolyn Atwood, and their two children, Sylvie Gard Atwood and Lars Gard Atwood. Granddaughter Raven Benson of Maple Grove, Minnesota. Brother Roger and Carol Gard of Danville, Iowa. Sisters Crystal Gard Kurtz of Omaha, Nebraska. And Candy and Robert Smith of Hereford, Arizona. Sister-in-law Julie Gard of Sioux City, and numerous nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, Lowell and Francis Gard, brother Kenneth Gard, grandparents, and numerous aunts and uncles. Family said goodbye to Joyce Marie Hofstadter Sandvold on Friday, June 10th, of 2022. Arrangements were with the Christie Smith Funeral Home's Morningside Chapel. Joyce was born in Council Bluffs, Iowa on August 8, 1948 to Ruth and Rudy Hofstadter, her two favorite people in all of the world. She has most recently been living in South Sioux City for the past year, and before then in Las Vegas, and in the local area of Mobile, Sioux City, Kingsland, and Lawton, where she spent her life working hard, having some fun, and loving and raising three children. Joyce attended and graduated from Woodbury Central High School in 1966. She then attended cosmetology school at Tyler Beauty School and worked as a stylist in salons around the area. Joyce also gave back to the beauty industry by teaching new students and sharing her skills with many as an instructor. She was an entrepreneur by heart, and she purchased the Merle Norman Cosmetics store in Sioux City and was an active owner and a friend to all of her customers, located in the Southern Hills Mall area for many years. She was married to Bill Butters, deceased, for most of her life, and they had three amazing children together, Scott, Blaine, and Brian. She was blessed to be able to marry her best friend, Roger Sandvold, on December 31, 1992, but only was able to spend a few years with him before his passing in October of 94. She has loved him forever since that day, and we are sure she was jumping for joy as she got to see his face again in heaven. Joyce loved Jesus and talked about how he helped her daily get through the hard times. When she was able, Joyce was involved in Morningside Lutheran Church in grief counseling and spent free time serving in the local soup kitchen. She loved Elvis, the color purple, teddy bears of all shapes and sizes, and popsicles were always one of her favorite treats for herself. She loved to cook, taste new recipes, sing karaoke, and go shopping on the day after Thanksgiving and Christmas. Christmas was her favorite holiday. She loved watching Hallmark the most, and it was on the TV all the time, but Dancing with the Stars, Home Makeover, and America's Got Talent were also some of her favorites to watch with her family and best friend. Joyce has now joined her parents, Rudy and Ruth Hofstadter, as well as husband Roger Sandvold in heaven, and we are sure she is smiling big. Her sons, Scott and his wife Susan, Blaine and Brian, all live in Fort Collins, Colorado, along with her two grandchildren, Trevor and fiancée Lindsay and Megan. Joyce has two brothers, Jim and Mike, along with their families that still live in the area, and her sister Susie, who now lives in Missouri. Joyce has nieces and nephews and their children that she loved very much and loved the time they took to spend with her. Her sons ask that you not be sad that she is gone from us on earth, but be happy and grateful to God that she is now healthy and happy again. We will be together again in heaven, they write. Kimberly K. Kim Watterson of North Sioux City, 66 years old, passed away on Friday, June 24th of 2022. Abiding by Kim's wishes, she will be cremated and no services will be held at this time. Arrangements are under the direction of Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Kim is survived by her husband, Jerry Watterson, son, Steve and Julie Watterson, two daughters, Teresa and Chad Kramer, and Jennifer and Derek Cooper, and three grandchildren, Hannah, Addison, and Dylan. Patsy D. Kemmer of Spirit Lake passed away on Wednesday, June 22nd, at the age of 88. She was the daughter of Everett and Devetta Headley Hogwood, and she was born on May 13, 1934, in Wayne, Nebraska. She began her education in Wayne. In 1944, the family moved to Sioux City. Patsy then attended Leeds School, graduating from Leeds High School in 1952. In 1953, she was united in marriage to William Pete Ralph. To this union, two children were born. In February of 1956, Pete was killed in a car accident. In April of 1958, she married Ron Kemner, and together they had a daughter. Patsy was a stay-at-home mom while the children were young. She then entered the workforce, working for the Sioux City school system in their main kitchen, and later at the courthouse in Woodbury County. Patsy is survived by her children, Pamela Payton of Gratinger, Iowa, Bradley and Gail Ralph of Sioux City, and Ann Fields of Yankton, South Dakota. Nine grandchildren, Jason and Kelly Petten, Kimberly and Alan Drost, Leslie and Mike Faust, Rebecca and Pierre Morita, Laura Ralph, Patrick and Miranda Ralph, Courtney Ralph, Daniel and Barb Fields, and Brittany and Jeff Mueller. She is also survived by several great-grandchildren, Sister Terry and John Van Horn, sister-in-law Patricia Isaacson, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her husbands, Pete and Ron, parents, sisters Betty and Tom McClim, and Judy and Tom Howard, and brother William. Memorials can be given to Keelson Harbor Memory Care Unit, Lakes Regional Hospice in Spirit Lake, or Dickinson County Relay for Life. And now on the Sioux City Journal newspaper for Wednesday, June 29th, turning to the opinion page. And here is from the Other Voices section. The headline says, "The Cancer That Is Killing Public Schools." And this article was written by Bruce Lear. Years ago, my mom sometimes hosted her Happy 20 Club. The ladies that came were well north of age 20, and now we're pushing the half-century mark, so gossip naturally had morphed from rumored salacious late-night rendezvous to who might suffer from what disease. But the ladies' grim but reverent whispers were reserved for the C word, cancer. It never seemed specific, but that C word hushed the room. But now, thanks to medical advances, cancer is no longer an automatic death sentence, and the grim whispers often now turn to shouts of remission. But that is not the case with the political cancer now threatening our cherished Iowa public schools. We can't rely on whispers, thoughts and prayers to save our schools. It's time to begin shouting about the diagnosis and working toward the cure. Medical science can't save our public schools from political cancer, but voters can. And even though we may not have caught it already or caught it earlier, there's still time if we believe in the diagnosis and take corrective action. Unlike medical cancer, there are direct causes for this cancer destroying the public school foundation that helped build Iowa. Here are some of the causes. Underfunding. For more than a decade, state public school funding has not kept pace with the cost of living. This year, with inflation running at more than 7%, and with a surplus of over $1 billion in the bank, the majority party decided 2.5% was an adequate increase. It was not. Another cause? Legislative setbacks. But that wasn't the only reason her plan failed, despite having Republican majorities in both chambers. Iowa already spends $100 million a year to support private schools and homeschooling. Now, her plan would add another $55 million in private school aid. And according to the Legislative Services Agency, the Reynolds scheme would siphon an additional $79 million a year from public school funding. This translates into a per-pupil loss for public schools of $275.93 if the governor pushes the same plan as she tried to jam through twice. For example, the Sioux City Community School has an enrollment of 14,868 students. The loss would be a total of $4,103 million. That's the diagnosis. What can we do to cure it? Well, the quickest remedy is to vote November 8 for the True Public Education Advocates. By their actions, the leadership of the Republican Party have chosen private schools over the public. This means 10,000 private students will benefit at the expense of the 480,000 public schools students in the state. Public schools should not be a partisan issue, but it is. The community school is often the biggest employer and is the center of many communities. And let's not let this political cancer metastasize and kill our public schools. And that was written by Bruce Lear. Bruce lives in Sioux City, and he's been connected to public schools for 38 years. He taught for 11 years and represented educators as an Iowa State Education Association regional director for 27 years until retiring. And from the opinion page again, this is from the Sioux City Journal editorial board, and the headline, Our Opinion, Summer Reasons for Thumbs Up and Thumbs Down. Thumbs down to Sioux City's crumbling infrastructure. A 110-year-old water main broke on Pierce Street on Tuesday, causing damage again to both the Orpheum Theater and the city's Wilbur Alfs Public Library. It was the third such water main break in the vicinity in the past year. Bottom line, fix it. Thumbs down to this summer's dry, rain-free weather. According to Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, almost all of northeast Iowa is under its 30-day average for rainfall, and most of Woodbury County is 2.5 to 3 inches below its 30-day average of rainfall for the week ending June 23rd. Please send rain. Thumbs up to Saturday in the Park. With no pipes to burst, Saturday's big festival should be one worth seeing. Slated to start at noon at Grandview Park, the 2022 festival features the Avid Brothers, Buddy Guy, Fet Rap, and more music, arts, and food than you can shake a grilled turkey leg at. And the headline for this next article from the Opinion page, Charisse Yaney, Could going green really cost us in the long run? With change comes unintended consequences, especially when a monumental alteration is happening to our infrastructure at a very fast pace. Electric cars, wind turbines, solar panels, what are the trade-offs? Will some of the new or expanded resources meet our needs? Are they as much or more harmful to our environment? Are we putting more children and adults at risk for serious or terminal diseases? I wrote about this over a year and a half ago, but the information is still pertinent today, such as the cost to dispose of wind turbine blades, the cost of mining lithium and cobalt, and where the minerals are being dug up for use in batteries. Solar panels have environmental issues because many components that are mined can cause lung disease, and they are linked to chemical pollution. And some of the concerns that I have, what minerals does it take to build a battery for an electric car? How much dirt has to be moved to get enough lithium and cobalt for batteries? How much danger are children or adults in that are mining the minerals? Could they die from a terminal illness from inhaling the minerals or die from an accident, especially in countries that don't have good safety laws? According to Mark P. Mills' article, Mines, Minerals, and Green Energy, in the Manhattan Institute report, left out of the discussion is any serious consideration of the broad environmental and supply chain implications of renewable energy. And he went on to say that all energy-producing machinery must be fabricated from materials extracted from the earth. No energy system is actually renewable, since all machines require the continual mining and processing of millions of tons of primary materials and disposal of hardware that inevitably wears out. And compared with hydrocarbons, green machines entail an average of a tenfold increase in quantities of materials extracted and processed to produce the same amount of energy. Well, that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper dated Wednesday, June the 29th. I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.